Hello, my name is Anne-Marie Cannon, and I'm the host of Armchair Historians. What's your favorite history? Each episode begins with this one question. Our guests come from all walks of life. YouTube celebrities, comedians, historians, even neighbors from the small mountain community that I live in. They're people who love history and get really excited about a particular time, place, or person from our distant or not-so-distant past. The jumping-off point is the place where they became curious, then entered the rabbit hole into discovery. Fueled by an unrelenting need to know more, we look at history through the filter of other people's eyes. Armchair Historians is a Belgian Rabbit production. Stay up to date with us through Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Wherever you listen to your podcast, that is where you'll find us. Armchair Historians is an independent, commercial-free podcast. If you'd like to support the show and keep it ad-free, you can buy us a cup of coffee through Ko-fi, or you can become a patron through Patreon. Links to both in the episode notes. Hello, fellow armchair historians, and welcome to another episode. Today, I talk to professor of history and author Robert McIlvaine about his latest book, The Times They Were A-Changin', 1964, the year the 60s arrived and the battle lines of today were drawn. 1964 is when the 60s truly arrived. From JFK's assassination in November 1963, it was then that the United States began a radical shift toward a much more inclusive definition of American. With a greater degree of equality and a government actively involved in social and economic improvement. It was a radical shift accompanied by a cultural revolution. The same month, Bob Dylan released his iconic ballad, The Times They Were A-Changin'. In January 1964, President Lyndon Johnson announced his war on poverty. McIlvaine uncovers 1964's moment of reckoning when American identity began to be reimagined, typing those past battles to their legacy today. Throughout, he captures the changing consciousness of the period through its vibrant music, film, literature, and personalities. McIlvaine is the Elizabeth Chisholm Distinguished Professor of Arts and Letters and Professor of History at Millsaps College. He is the author of 7 books, including The Great Depression, America, 1929-1941, and Eve Seed, Biology, The Sexes and the Course of History. Robert McIlvaine, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So we just get right into the races here, and I'm going to ask you, what is your favorite history right now?
Yes, well, the right now narrows it down to the book that I just finished. But before we get into that, I really have a couple of other areas at different times in my career. Early part of my career, I was mostly writing about the Great Depression and either published as the sole writer or editor of 5 different books on that. Then I got into a long period, which I'm still kind of in, focusing on how history has been shaped from the earliest times by the subordination of women and how that came about and how that has affected other things, basically contending that the idea a man is superior to woman is the basis of all other hierarchical ideas that humans have had, that any time somebody, especially one man to another, is asserting I'm superior to you, whether it's race, class, nationality, whatever, the inferior one is being associated with women. This goes right down to the language and can perhaps catapult us more into what my current book is about, comparing the way things changed in 1964 with how the right wing is trying to change them back now. But you can very clearly see in the right wing now, just in the hearings, when sometimes they bleep the words and sometimes they don't, of Trump referring to people who won't do his bidding as pussies and so forth. It's always the whole language, refer to it as verbal mounting, because some other species of animals, a defeated male, will be mounted by the victorious one, sort of simulating intercourse. And it's kind of hard to imagine that other species have metaphors, but this clearly is saying, I am superior to you. You are now like a woman. All of the vulgar language, essentially, that we use is asserting one man saying to another, I am to you like man is to woman, therefore you are inferior. Now, though, I've been working for decades, really on the 1960s, off and on, since back when I was living in the 1960s, and I keep doing other things. And for a long time, I was going to try to write a complete history of the 1960s, which nobody has ever really done by, you know, incorporating everything, politics, culture, all the rest of that together with Vietnam. And so much is going on that nobody has ever brought it together. It's kind of what I did in my book on the Great Depression, to kind of bring film and music and everything together with what's going on. And that was kind of possible with the Great Depression. But I eventually realized that the reason nobody's done that kind of a book on the 60s, it would take like 3,000 pages. So after a long period of time, I focused more and more and got down to looking at what I call the long 1964, which I define as from the Kennedy assassination in November of 1963 into mid-1965 with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, Watts, things getting worse in Vietnam, and so on.
So what's the name of the book?
The Times They Were a Change in 1964, the year the 60s arrived and the battle lines of today were drawn.
A little bit more about how 1964 drew the battle lines for today, as you assert.
Yeah, well, one thing, of course, recently with the 1619 Project over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of debate about what America is, the right wing trying to seize 1776. The thing is that even the 1619 Project was never intended to indicate that that was more important than the ideals. It would say the existence of enslavement in the background, at least for the most of the white people, was as important as the ideals. And so, in a sense, it seems to me that you've had throughout American history a reality that has included a lot of things that flow from enslavement and genocide and all sorts of things that current Republicans don't want people to know about or be taught about. And they weren't before about 1964, by the way. But on the other hand, America has always been the ideal of 1776. The founders, so many of them were enslavers themselves, but they set up something that really was an experiment, something that had not been tried before. It's interesting, there's a book came out about a year ago, not directly history, called The Dawn of Everything by two anthropologists, which is fascinating in all sorts of ways that I'm not going to try to take time to get into now. But one important thing they bring out is that it seems pretty clear that the Enlightenment came from indigenous people in North America, that the whole idea that you could have a government based on coming up from the bottom rather than down from the top didn't exist in Europe at that time and hadn't. You know, with the sort of weird things about Greek democracy wasn't all that democratic just for the citizens. But since those days and for hundreds or more years in Europe, the idea was always flowing, power flows down from the top. And several of the Native American nations in the areas of North America that the French and British went into had much more egalitarian societies. And some of the leading thinkers from the indigenous people actually traveled to France in particular. And man, I think a Huron, that may not be the right nation, but in any event, his name was Condillac. And he attended all the salons in Paris and was really influential on Voltaire and Montesquieu and all these people, which in turn eventually becomes how Jefferson's ideas are developing and even Madison's ideas. So that's kind of fascinating in itself. But so when they put that out, of course, the idea that all men are created equal didn't, they knew perfectly well, didn't reflect the reality. Mm-hmm. And so you know, that's kind of been the conflict all along. And I mean, somebody like Thomas Jefferson directly embodies that. He states these wonderful ideals, and yet in reality, he's an enslaver. Even to the point, I just ran across a letter of Jefferson's sometime around 1819, 1820, in which he's just casually talking about how women as slaves are a much better investment because they produce more property for you in the form of other owned human beings. Mm. And this is the guy who's saying all these ideals. So that, it seems to me, has been the conflict in American history. Another thing that, moving a little bit later, that embodies that, after the enslavers' rebellion, more accurate term for the Civil War, during when Grant was running, in 1868, the Democratic candidates, whose names I don't really remember myself, they lost, but their slogan, the Democratic slogan, was, "This is a white man's country, let white men rule." And it seems to me that's been the question of American history. Whether it is a white man's country, with the emphasis on both of those words, or really is what the ideals of 1776 implied, if you take man to mean humans, are all equal. And so it's been kind of a tug and war between the two. And jumping forward to 1964, what happened in 1964-65 on that front is that for the first time, the United States actually became a full democracy through the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Prior to that, the 50s are still, what we think of as the 50s, are still kind of going on until 1964. The early 60s were kind of part of the 50s. And so that was a really dramatic change. And one of the main things that the MAGA Republicans are trying to do now is well, they've been trying to do it for a long time, but they're much closer to succeeding now, is to erase the 60s. The Republicans have kind of been the anti-60s party since the 60s. You know, all that stuff is, we need to go back to make America great again means make America white male ruled again.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about what happened that was so pivotal in that year that you started in November of 1963 and that following year. What happened and what preceded it to that point where things were evolving?
Yeah, well, of course, the civil rights movement was well underway before 1964, attempting to kind of start maybe around the time of the Birmingham confrontations in the spring of 63. But if I was going to say 1964, I wanted to not keep expanding it out that much. Mm-hmm. But the change that occurred with Johnson replacing Kennedy is important. If you look at the major inflection points in American history, you usually see a very important leader, like Lincoln during the Enslavers' Rebellion, FDR in the 30s, and Lyndon Johnson is that leader at this time in the 60s. He kind of has not gotten enough credit for it because, basically, of one word, Vietnam. I say in the book, a little equation, LBJ minus Vietnam equals Mount Rushmore plus LBJ. Enormously successful. But I argue that while this leadership is important, what's more important is the mood of the time, the zeitgeist. And that's what I try to do in the book, is to talk about what's going on culturally as well as the coming up from below, but culturally, and then Johnson coming down from above, all comes together. And a very interesting coincidence that, well, coincidences are sometimes, people say it's a mere coincidence, and some coincidences are mere coincidences, but others indicate that there's something in the air. And a striking one occurs in the early weeks of 1964. Johnson gives his State of the Union address, in which he declares unconditional war on poverty, which he says that the time has come to end all racism in the country. And 5 days later, Bob Dylan's, I think, third studio album, titled The Times They Are Changing, comes out. And the title song in that is almost exactly reflecting in a different way the sentiments that Johnson was talking about in his address to Congress 5 days earlier. Mm-hmm. The first ones now will later be last. The times are changing. I think that this really does reflect something. One of the things I point out, the song was written a few months earlier before Johnson came along, but when Dylan wrote it in, I think it was October of 1963, Kennedy, of course, was still president, one of Dylan's friends came along and saw a copy of it and picked it up, and he said, come senators and congressmen. He says, what is this shit, man? And Dylan said, Dylan said, I don't know. It seems to be what people want to hear. And that's the point. It was what people want to hear. And so I argue that unconsciously and both, I'm sure Lyndon Johnson must have sung out of key as I do. And I can't carry a tune at all, but I often say, but I can do a passable Bob Dylan. In any event, they couldn't have harmonized at all, but they were an unconscious duet. And if that duet had a name, it would be Zeitgeist. They're you know, Dylan's a little bit earlier song, Blowing in the Wind thing. These ideas were blowing in the wind. And then very rapidly after that, all sorts of things happened. The British invasion, the Beatles actually were supposed to be played for the first time back on November, talked about on a TV show in the United States for the first time on November 22nd, 1963, but other events intervened with the assassination. And so they arrive in the United States at the end of January, the beginning of February, at the same time that the first Beatles song came from, it was kind of out of nowhere to be number one, I Want to Hold Your Hand, another song that had been rapidly rising, Leslie Gore's You Don't Own Me, reached number two. And were it not for the Beatles having arrived, she would have been number one for the next few weeks. The song, of course, was written by two men, but here was a woman singing You Don't Own Me. Mm-hmm. revolutionary stuff. And were it not for the Beatles having arrived, it would be the number one song in the country. And so that's happening. One of the ways that compares to now, our friends, or perhaps not friends, on the Supreme Court answered You Don't Own Me with Yes, We Do, Bitch, a couple of weeks ago. And so the clear idea of overturning that. And there are other indications of the start of the women's movement. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, had come out in hardcover the year before, and it had done fairly well, but it was in 1964 with the paperback that it was just a sensational bestseller. And later that year, another song came out. Gail Garnett will sing in the sunshine. And this, too, was revolutionary because what she was singing was what traditionally these songs by men were about, you know, moving from one woman to the other, you know, Ricky Nelson, Traveling Man, I've got a girl in every port. I mean, just one after another. In fact, the whole early rock and roll through the 50s, almost into the 60s, was the makeup of it in terms of the gender of the singers was essentially the same as the gender makeup of the Catholic Church. They were all male, and it was almost all, they tried to tone it down, but it was almost all about male sexual bravado and how we can get as many women as possible. Now, here was a woman saying, you know, I'll stay with you 1 year, but then I'll move on. And so all that stuff is going on. Then, during what I think is the most important event there's so many going on. In 1964, Mississippi Freedom Summer Project during the summer, lots of things come out of that, but one of them that comes out of it is that women who were involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, very much committed to trying to gain freedom and equality for Black people, started seeing that even within the movement, they were being treated as inferiors, that they were being told that you can't head any of the sub-projects. I mean, they weren't being quite told you can't, they just weren't given an opportunity to do so. They were seen as useful to be taking notes and making coffee and providing sex and that sort of thing. But a lot of the people who were, as they put it, so hip to racial discrimination seemed to be totally clueless about sexual discrimination. And so two of them, Casey Hayden and Mary King, wrote what was supposed to be an anonymous position paper in November of 64 when the SNCC veterans of the Summer Project were getting together in Waveland, Mississippi to discuss what had happened and where they should go from now. And Mary King and Casey Hayden wrote this supposedly anonymous, it quickly was apparent to the others who had written it, called The Position of Women in SNCC. And that, published in a slightly different form the next year, really became the basis for the more radical women's movement that emerged. So one of the things coming out of the 1964-65 period is this, what came to be called second wave feminism, which produced all sorts of changes over the next several years, ultimately leading to the Roe decision in early 1973. So again, all of that is what the right is trying to overthrow today.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in everything you've said. But let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the Roe decision being overturned. And obviously, we're going backwards. We're going backwards. And I feel this sense of hopelessness of being able to stop this tide. You know, you're talking about the zeitgeist of that time and the zeitgeist of this time. What is happening?
Yeah, well, what is happening is a lot of people that the media keep referring to as conspiracy theorists. They're not theorists at all. They're conspiracy lunatics and so forth. But a genuine conspiracy has been going on for at least 40 years, since around 1980, with roots back before that. Such books as Jane Mayer's Dark Money, Nancy McLean's Democracy in Chains, Kurt Anderson's Evil Geniuses are all document that groups of, maybe some of them weren't yet billionaires because there wasn't that much money, but people were billionaires now and extremely rich people, determined to free themselves from such problems as government regulation and taxation, working behind the scenes to try to essentially go back to the way things were in the early 19th century, to go back to John C. Calhoun's ideas of property rights superseding people's rights, human rights, to go back to the way Calhoun had seen that in like the 1830s and 40s, the way to preserve property rights, by which he meant the right to own human beings, was to concentrate power at the state level and against the federal government. So starting even around the time of the Brown decision in 1954, some people on the right were seeing that the only way we're going to be able to do this is that the trend is of the nation as a whole is in a much more liberal direction. Like after the New Deal, late 40s, 50s, early 60s, time of really great prosperity for the country, the growth of the greatest in size and wealth, middle class that the world has ever seen. And this was based on a sort of idea of an acceptance of the social contract. People who want to go back to the 50s now don't mention that the top marginal tax rate in the 50s was about 90%, but labor unions were strong. All that was sort of accepted, but not by some very rich people who wanted to go back to the good old days of Calvin Coolidge, or better, William McKinley, the first Gilded Age. And so in 1964, people like that, as well as white supremacists and others, came together to not really fully take over the Republican Party, but take over enough of the state party apparatus to nominate Barry Goldwater. And actually, it was around this week, mid-July of 1964, that they met in San Francisco. Interesting comparison to what's going on now. Norman Mailer, writing about the people at the Goldwater Convention in San Francisco, said that they were a band of, I forget exactly what word he used, but that their idea was a band of executioners who believes that the hangman, too, has his rights. And thinking about January 6th and the noose and all of that. Governor Nelson Rockefeller of New York, liberal Republican, was shouted off the stage by the Goldwater people in 1964. A proposed addition to the platform of the party that would condemn such extremist groups as the John Birch Society and the Ku Klux Klan was shouted down by an overwhelming no. They didn't even hold a vote on it. Jackie Robinson, who was had been a lifelong Republican, the first black person to play in Major League Baseball, said that being on the floor of the Republican Convention in 1964, I felt for the first time that now I think I know what it was like to be a Jew in Hitler's Germany. Some people were yelling racial epithets at the, it was like 1.6% of the delegates were black. This was still considered the party of Lincoln at that time. And so this is a real foretaste of where the Republican Party would be going, but not yet really, certainly not where the country was going. Goldwater went down to enormous defeat. And not really where the party as a whole was yet. The majority of Republicans voted for both the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, and majority Republicans in Congress. But it was a real foretaste of where things were going. You can compare that to the recent Texas Republican State Convention, where they passed this platform with all sorts of things that you must teach lies about history, you know, say that the Alamo was this great thing, this mythological history, that life begins at conception, all the rest of this stuff. And even John Cornyn, who is a very conservative fellow himself, was kind of booed off the stage by these people, home state U.S. Senator in Texas, the way Governor Rockefeller was at the National Republican Convention in 64. So you can see where that was going from that time. In fact, when Goldwater made his infamous statement, his acceptance speech, saying extremism in defense of liberty is no vice, Lyndon Johnson was talking to his aide, Bill Moyers, later that night or the next day, and he said, what did Goldwater say? And Moyers told him, and Johnson responded that something to the effect of, well, the effects of extremism are vices. And he just sort of chuckled, and he knew that this was going to be totally unpopular. And pushed through that idea throughout the campaign and won just an overwhelming victory in 1964. And so the people who were taking over, not a majority of Republicans nationwide, but took over the party in 64, were clearly not where things were yet at that time, but that's where the people who have taken over the Republican Party now want to take it back to. As recently as, I think it was 2006, every Republican in the Senate voted to extend the Voting Rights Act. Now, all 50 Republicans in the Senate wouldn't even allow voting rights to be debated on the floor. It's just amazing.
I still find it shocking. I guess prior to Trump, I was pretty ignorant, and I still cannot get a grasp on the truth of this makeup of our country, that so many people can be, or their belief systems are basically moving us backwards. I guess that's the best way I can say it, but threaten to take away my human rights, my mm-hmm. daughter's human rights. Mm-hmm. So where do we see this hit? We're going to change gears here.
Sure.
Where do we see this history in pop culture?
I use pop culture a lot in teaching and in writing. I could more easily talk about about how in the times popular culture is reflective of what kind of the zeitgeist, the general sentiment is. For instance, in 1964, almost exactly the same time, January going into February, the other things I mentioned earlier were happening. Dr. Strangelove came out. Dr. Strangelove was actually scheduled to premiere on the evening of the Kennedy assassination, and they decided to hold it off for about 2 months. But it came out, and it was an unexpected, huge hit. And it is totally kind of mocking the Cold War mentality, indicating that you could have these crazy people, somebody could actually destroy the world by, well, the main underlying thing is because of masculine insecurity. General Jack D. Ripper has lost his precious bodily fluids. I learned it, he says. Of course, it's a so-called dark comedy, or even more than dark, a midnight kind of comedy. He says, I first realized that I had lost my essence when I was engaged in the act of love, meaning he couldn't perform. And then he says, I don't avoid women, but I do deny them my essence. And so he blames this on communists, women, and fluoridation of the water, which was actually part of the right-wing complaint at the time that fluoridation was a communist plot. And so the whole thing leads to that. Well, there were people at the time that included a general named Walker, who had been dismissed by Kennedy, who was basically in favor of overthrowing the government. Curtis LeMay, who was actually in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the Air Force chief at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and Kennedy, you know, just the guy's totally out of his mind, was saying to bomb Cuba, and, you know, basically if we have a nuclear war, that's so much the better. They were kind of the models for these people in Dr. Strangelove. Well, they're like General Flynn now and these other lunatics. I mean, they're mm-hmm. the same sort of thing. And so that comes out in February, maybe the end of January of 1964. A few weeks later, Cassius Clay, soon to be renamed Muhammad Ali, defeats Sonny Liston in late February, and just sort of a revolution in his kind of approach, and becomes a worldwide celebrity, embraced by much of the white youth as well as the black and Muslim world. Malcolm X and Cassius Clay had become very close, but Elijah Muhammad, the head of the Nation of Islam, who was a total con man, and Malcolm X began to realize that. Muhammad Ali didn't for a very long time. But all that's going on at the same time. Another movie that came out in February, I believe it was, in 1964, 7 Days in May, which was based on a book from 2 years earlier about a coup in the United States headed by right-wing people in the military. Kennedy had read the book and urged Paramount, I believe it was a studio, to do a movie on it, because he thought this was a real possibility with people like this General Edwin Walker I mentioned and Curtis LeMay, that something like this could happen. I just wrote a piece, I'm not sure. Yeah, it is supposed to be published soon. 7 Days in June, about how this fictional plot that's talked about in the movie 7 Days in May in 1964 is foiled. A all-too-real plot to use violence to have a coup didn't quite succeed, although it came perilously close in early January of 2021. You could call that 6 days in January. Mm. However, the Supreme Court has shown that you can have a coup without any violence. Woody Guthrie's song, late 30s, The Ballad of Pretty Boy Floyd, there are a couple of lines in it that say, some people rob you with a six gun, some people rob you with a fountain pen. And what these people that they managed to put on the Supreme Court have done is just say, we can take away everybody's liberties and we are unaccountable to everybody. You don't need violence to do that. So I'm calling that 7 days in June, the last 7 days of the court session from the Dobbs decision overturning Roe to the EPA decision, which undermines the power of the executive branch to regulate business and the environment and everything, and the likelihood that they will try to move on to say that states can just ignore democracy being an effective coup that was carried out kind of out of public sight.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we could talk about why didn't Trump's attempt to overthrow the government work?
First of all, I'd say that he somehow, like other so-called strongmen, all of whom I believe clearly are men who, in fact, are totally insecure about their own masculinity. I mean, Trump, he actually tweeted a thing sometime about 2 years or 3 years into this presidency of this boxer's body and his head on it, like, you know, I am this real man. Yeah. I mean, he's just pathetic the way he is. I mean, he, in one of the primary debates in 2016, he said on national, in fact, I was overseas at the time and saw it on CNN internationally, he bragged about the size of his penis. Well, you know, it's just axiomatic that a man who brags about the size of his penis is actually saying it's small. He said the same sorts of things other times. He said I don't need Viagra. I need a pill to make my erection smaller. I mean, the man's out of his mind. One of the really weird things to me is it's more interesting the followers than the leaders. That these people, especially the men who are attracted to the so-called strong man, the alpha male, and we're going to associate with them. Well, they're as pathetic as he is, because what they're doing, not in reality that this is what women are, but in their own worldview, women are these inferior people who just should do what they're told and be submissive. And that's exactly what they are putting themselves in towards the leader, towards Trump. We will follow you anywhere. We will submit to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the people in his cabinet and everything were that way.
Right.
So why did it fail? It came, I mean, we learn more with each hearing how close it came to succeeding. I mean, part of why it failed was luck. But also, there were people around Trump who, you know, as bad as they were going along with a lot of the things, were just not willing to take that step that we're going to encourage a violent revolution. The latest hearing, at least at the time we're recording this, had the witnesses, one of whom was one of the people who broke into the Capitol, who was really just a typical ordinary American, a worker from Ohio, who was caught up in all this and talked about how he followed Trump on Twitter and all his friends on social media were saying all these things, and he believed it was all true, and so it was his obligation to go to Washington, and then he went on, and so he thought he needed to go into the Capitol when I think he was sort of just in the right place when they broke through the doors and went in. I think one of the most important things that came out of this was that he said at the end, when he was asked, I think by Chairman Thompson, about, you know, how do you feel about all this now and about people who still follow Trump? And he said, well, I had like horse blinders on the whole time. I could only see what was in front of me on the screen and that sort of thing. And really what other people following Trump need to do is take those horse blinders mm-hmm. off. And this kind of coming from, you know, not some intellectual or lefty or anything, but somebody who was caught up in the Trump cult. I think if like his testimony closing with that could actually reach these people, like they're not going to show it on Fox News or anything, would have some effect. As Jesse Jackson used to say, keep hope alive.
Keep hope alive. It's hard to do sometimes.
It is.
So where can we find you?
You can find me in a lot of places, but probably the easiest would just be to go to my website, which I will send you, and you can probably have in print, and I may not remember it exactly, but I think it's just www.robertsmcilvain.com, and that can lead you to a lot of other things.
Okay.
You can also, the book, The Times There Were a Change in 1964, the year the 60s arrived, and the battle lines of today were drawn. You can find independent bookstores online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the rest. You can also find information about me by putting in my name at Simon & Schuster and a page there about the book. Also, biographical information mm-hmm. about me there as well.
Okay. And I'll definitely link out to those. To that in my episode notes. Robert McElvey, I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for being here today.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
There you have it. Robert McElvein in The Times They Were a Change In. Be sure to check out our episode notes for more information about Robert and the book. Thanks for joining us and have a great week.